upstate.
South Carolina, North Carolina, and western or eastern Georgia. Glad to have you with us today on Talking Money. This is Certified Financial Planner Mike Miller, your host for today. We've got a special, very special program for you today. It's not too often that you get someone to join us that has been as prolific and as well-read and well-spoken and been on so many different venues as a Forbes contributor. As a contributing editor, the Affluent Investor, has been on CNBC as a contributor and Fox Business News. And I met him at a Kingdom Advisors conference a number of years ago. He's a regular speaker at their annual conference. And there's just a few people that are regular speakers. And Jerry Boyer is one of those speakers. And I saw him a month, 6 weeks, 8 weeks ago. At the last conference, and asked him if he would mind joining me on Talking Money to just talk about the economy, talk about different ways to invest, what his thoughts are on things going forward. So I'm going to welcome Jerry, calling us from eastern Pennsylvania. Good morning, Jerry, and welcome to Talking Money.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Hope you are.
I am.
Well, thanks.
Yes.
Thanks for joining me on a Saturday morning. I'm sure there's other things you could be doing and probably would rather be doing. Although I know you like to talk and you like to educate. So we want to do some of that today. So Jerry, you've been on a lot of different things. I think it'd be interesting for our listeners to know. I remember a couple of years ago you were talking about how you were on CNBC as one of those talking heads, and I picked on one of those talking heads last week when I talked about some things. Jim, I call him Jim Cramer, but Jim Cramer was on back in 08 when he was telling people to get out of the market if you had any needs for the next 5 years to get out of the market. And I was warning people back then, don't listen. That's too long. Don't cave into those kinds of that kind of scary tactics, I think, that sells better than it does come into reality. So you decided not to do Fox Business News and CNBC. I thought the reasoning was pretty interesting, maybe a little off topic, but I think it might be interesting for the people to get some perspective on the people who are on there all the time and why you decided, that's not for me anymore.
Well, the reason I decided to stop doing it is because the more often I was on, the dumber I got.
Okay.
And what I found is that the basic pattern is that the way to be on TV all the time is to be on TV all the time. That if you say yes, then that makes it easy for producers. And the more often you say yes, the higher up they have you on their speed dial. And that's why you see the same people there over and over and over again. But they're talking about all sorts of different topics, right? They're talking about the news of the day. And the news of the day is different every day.
Right.
Which means that they're either super geniuses who know all sorts of topics, wide range of topics, geopolitical risk in the South China Sea to, you know, whether some lizard in Texas will be threatened if we drill for oil and everything in between. Either they're super geniuses, walking encyclopedia, PEI, I guess, who know all these things. Or they're mostly winging it. And the answer is they're mostly winging it.
Mostly winging it, yeah.
And cable doesn't force you to not wing it, because hosts are often winging it. I mean, they're not super geniuses either. Now, some of these people are friends of mine. I don't mean to be mean to them. I'm just saying that's the way the system works. So I realized that if you're spending time on the air a lot, if you're saying yes, because it had gotten to the point where I was on 4 or 5 times a week, and I thought, well, when do I research? When do I manage money? When do I read books?
Right.
When do I study the scriptures?
Yeah.
When do I get deep? And what I found is if you're doing that all the time, you're running from appointment to appointment, reading enough headlines to get a general view that you can sort of speak a sentence on each topic, then you're going to get shallow, you're going to get dumb. And I got to know people in the green room as well, and I realized that this is a system that dumbs down not just the content, but the guests themselves.
Well, I think I was often told, because I've done quite a bit of work on local channel for NBC's station, and the comment advice really I got, strong suggestion, was make sure that your answers would appeal to Joe Sixpack. And so you were going, that's where they were going, that just the average Joe. And so you weren't really trying to necessarily lift everybody up to a higher level of conversation. It, as you said, it kind of dumbed it down. And that was
Over time, I came to realize that Joe Sixpack, whoever he is, average viewer,
right,
might be a little smarter than the average producer.
Right.
He keeps thinking he needs to talk down to people.
Right.
I mean, I live in a very blue collar area. I live in Western Pennsylvania. This is the inner ring suburbs of Pittsburgh, steel town. A lot of people, who do drink a six pack and who carried a lunch bucket to work. And you know what? They're smart. They read, and they want more depth out of their television than the television's giving them.
Yeah, that's very true. I found the same thing to be true. And it's unfortunate. That's what much of the media has gotten down to. But you're right. They want the sound bite, something to get in and get out. I was on a couple of weeks ago after Trump made his speech to Congress. And I think my contribution to that 3-minute segment was at least the on-air part was probably 25 seconds. So you can't get much depth in 25 seconds. Anyway, so I'm glad you're out of that rat race, so you can spend more time researching and doing some of the things that really mean something to people's lives. And you're currently, I know, involved with Vidant Financial as well as Ronald Blue and Company. And Ronald Blue and Company, for those who don't know, is a very large wealth management firm, financial planning firm, fee-only firm out of Atlanta, managing, I think, around $6.5 billion, and a very effective Christian financial planning firm as well. And it's nice to see a firm that size who does espouse Christian principles and very overtly does so. So what is your role currently there? Because I think it'd be good for people to understand where you're coming from and the expertise that you bring to the microphone today.
I'm a senior economic advisor for Ronald Blue and Company, which means I do their economic forecasts, GDP and CPI. Not just for the United States, but for 40 nations around the world. I also do some other things with them, some communications and discussion of markets, and work with them, say, on statistical methods, creating better models for allocation of portfolios. My main job is with Vidant. So what's Vidant? Vidant Financial is a company started by Ronald Blue to run portfolios. And the idea was to start a company and spin it off so there's no conflict of interest, put it under a trust so that, the profits aren't coming back to Blue, so that it can create investment solutions, ETFs in this case. But I should assume that folks listening are familiar with ETFs. They're not mutual funds, but, people used to invest in mutual funds, and now there's been a movement more towards ETFs, which they're similar to mutual funds.
Sure.
Traded funds.
We've had discussions about those, but never hurts to say it again to just remind folks what the difference is.
Yeah. One of them is that your capital gains don't flow through or don't have to flow through, so that when the fund sells a security, that doesn't necessarily trigger a taxable event for you. So that's one of the things that's a little bit advantageous over mutual funds, and they're just more tradable. They're just for the electronic era. They're more liquid. They're more efficient. That's not anything against mutual funds. Mutual funds are great, but we just decided to use those vehicles.
Sure.
So what we did is we the idea behind Vidant Financial was to take the approach that we called principled reasoning approach to investment. And principled reasoning, and let me just distinguish it from sort of the standard views. Modern portfolio theory says that market movement is basically random. It doesn't have anything to do with the underlying economy. And there's no way to beat the market, by which it means there's no way to beat the S&P or some kind of cap-weighted passive investment. That there's no real cause and effect in financial markets. That the only risk is that prices move around, the random movement of prices, which is called variance, or more recently it's called volatility. And the markets are more efficient than any investor can be. The markets are efficient, that they don't make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are no such things as bubbles or busts, or if there are, they're undetectable. So that's efficient market theory, and that basically took over the academy. I mean, every finance department in the developed world teaches that as dogma. We don't think that's right. We don't think the data fits it. We think there are real things that are risky, like, for instance, when countries do stupid things, like tax people who are productive at much higher rates than people who aren't as productive, or weaken property rights or debase their currencies. We think that these things are bad over the long run for markets, so that there is a cause and effect relationship, and it's not all just randomness. The other philosophy is sort of no philosophy at all. I think you see it with Jim Cramer, as you put it, which is the smartest guy in the room. I'm the smartest guy in the room. What it really is I'm the most confident guy in the room. And either I went to these three Ivy League universities or, you know, I'm just a scrapper, or hedge fund managers talk this way. I've got the best secret sauce. I've really complicated mathematical models. They're so complicated I can't possibly explain to them because you, Joe Sixpack, can't understand them. But I'm really smart, and I'm the smartest guy, and I'm on TV a lot, or I have this resume, and therefore I'll beat the market. And that doesn't really work. You know, people who go to Ivy League universities are no more likely to beat the market than people who don't go to Ivy League
Absolutely.
Universities. Yeah. People who are completely confident and have confidence in their voice and go on TV a lot don't beat the market. Jim Cramer is the master of that. Right? Goldman Sachs, Ivy League University, and he screams and he shows off everything he knows. And people have done analysis of Jim's suggestions.
His performance,
and he underperforms even the passive indices. So, you know, our approach is we're not trying to be the smartest people in the room, and we do not believe that markets are perfectly efficient and unbeatable. We just think that there are certain foundational principles that are conducive towards growth, like boards of directors and company managers who put the shareholder ahead of their own interest, and countries with the national leadership of which have strong commitment to rule of law, property rights, low taxes, low spending, good demographics, that these are the principles. And if you agree with those principles, then that's the way to invest your money and ignore the academic dogma or the smartest and loudest guy in the room.
Okay, very, very well said. We're speaking with Jerry Boyer. He's an economist and contributed to a lot of different places. We got to go to our first break, Jerry. So I will open the phone lines, 877-235-9405. If you want to send me a text or a phone call, we'll be glad to take that and get you on the phone with Jerry so that you can get his thoughts on whatever your question is. And when we get back, we'll first talk about some information or some thoughts on, you know, what's a business recession versus what we feel is a consumer recession from the GDP and so forth, and how that relates to some other things that you've written about recently about copper and how copper prices would signal different future growth or lack of growth in the economy. We'll talk about that when we get back. But 877-235-9405 is the number if you want to get to us. We'll be right back with more of Talking Money in just a couple of minutes. Plan First is excited to sponsor Talking Money, now in its 11th year of broadcasting. I believe Plan First is unique in the financial services profession for a couple of reasons. The level of education and experience of the Plan First team makes us specially qualified to provide the level of financial planning I think so many people need. Our goal is to utilize every technique and planning tool that's available to help you pay as little in taxes as possible. I'm sure you like that. Develop an estate plan that not only minimizes estate and gift taxes, but more importantly, I think it maximizes the effective transfer of the estate to the next generation, or maybe you prefer having some of it go to a ministry. We want to help create and implement a retirement income strategy. We also want to construct a portfolio that's going to satisfy your income needs, but we want to do it within that risk level with which you are comfortable. Now, to help avoid the obvious conflicts of interest that so many brokers and other, quote, financial advisors, unquote, who represent their company, not you, Plan First operates as a true fee-only, and we don't want to be confused with a fee-based firm. We have no commissions, no kickbacks, or no fee splits. We never receive any of that. Our only compensation is very transparent, and based on what I've seen, very competitive. It's a fee that's deducted right from your account each quarter. As a true fiduciary, Plan First works for you. If you'd like to know more, or if you think this is something worth checking out, please call Plan First at 1-800-588-7526 to speak with me, Mike Miller, or one of our advisors. Of course, you can always simply check us out at planfirst.com. Now back to Talking Money. This is Mike Miller. You're listening to This is Talking Money. Our phone number, 877-235-9405. If you want to send us a text or give us a call, we'd be glad to hear from you. My guest today, Jerry Boyer, he is an economist. He's chief economic person for Ronald Blue & Company. And Jerry, we've got an article that I've been looking at, researched, did a little research on you, and found this great article, Markets Say Recession is Over, But No Trump Boom Yet. And in that, you start off by talking about how a business recession can be such different and is different than a personal recession. So talk to us about that just a little bit.
Well, the standard definition of a recession is two quarters of negative GDP growth, negative gross domestic product growth. So two quarters of contraction in the output. The problem is the GDP doesn't actually measure output. GDP only measures one slice of output. GDP only measures final sales. And that's because the people who created that statistic, GDP, were Keynesians. What does that mean? John Maynard Keynes is the most influential economist of the 20th century, and we can get into his personal background, but he reacted against the Victorianism under which he was raised. The Victorian era said it's good to be thrifty, and Keynes said, no, spending is good for the economy. And so his disciples created a metric that only counts our spending.
Right.
Doesn't count capital, doesn't count the vast majority of investment, doesn't count the actual business process. It counts when you go to the store and buy inventory off the shelf, but it doesn't count all the steps in the process by which that inventory is created, from raw materials to intermediate goods and all the way up. So it's really keyed to consumption, and consumption is not really the key to the economy. Production is. Yeah, of course we have to buy it. But the trick isn't getting people to want to buy things. The trick is getting people to want to produce things. That's the bottleneck. You know, human nature is I want everything and I don't want to work. So, you know, the best economic policies are the economic policies that give people incentive to work and produce things. And then, yes, of course, they'll make money producing those things and then they'll use it to buy things. So production is prior to consumption. So a friend of mine named Mark Skousen, a really brilliant, gifted free market economist, created another metric where he counts the steps before it gets to inventory, all the steps in the business process. And it turns out that he was so influential and persuasive that the government said, okay, you're right, we'll keep that statistic. So now the government keeps that statistic, and it's called general output. And it's a little more than twice the size of GDP, and it counts the before steps. One of the things that enables you to do is to see what's going on in the supply chain and to see what's going on in the productive process. And what you'll see sometimes is that business will contract even if there's not technically a recession. What that means is if business is contracting but people still feel confident, they'll keep buying for a while. So you actually can get more information out of looking at the whole economy than you can by just looking at that end decision of people whether to purchase what they usually purchase or not.
Certainly that would give you a precursor of what was coming, as opposed to looking in hindsight and say, oh yes, we're in a recession. When businesses start to contract and pull back, people may not stop spending yet, but as they lose jobs and those kind of things, of course that spending would eventually go down.
That's right. If business contracts and it's a lengthy contraction, unemployment or employment, however you want to put it, they're complements of one another, are lagging indicators. I mean, it's just common sense. You know, you're a business manager. I'm a business manager. I don't lay people off until I absolutely need to.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, business managers, they wait to lay people off. They're not heartless fiends, which means that when there's a business contraction, usually it doesn't show up in the job market for a little while. And then when you get a lot of layoffs, then people stop spending. Then they say, oh, this is serious. You know, I heard down at the plant that things were bad, but I didn't think it was serious, so I bought the boat anyway. But if that goes on for a long time or gets really bad, then people get laid off, or there's pay cuts, or there's cutbacks in hours, and then they start to change their spending pattern. This is what Milton Friedman won his Nobel Prize for, by the way, by pointing out that people spend in accordance with their long-term expectations of income. So they don't. You know, if government does a stimulus, package where they send money out, where they just send checks out.
Free money.
Free money. It doesn't really change people's spending pattern. If they feel confident, they'll spend it like they would have, and if they don't feel confident, they won't. People basically spend based on how well they think they're going to do over the long run. So these little tricks don't really work. And by looking at general output and looking at business activity separately, you can get a sense of business is more responsive. Business changes faster. It's more agile than consumers. And so that gives us a better idea about what's going
on. Well, we've all seen the surveys that will be done. Even times are bad, and people will ask, what do they think about the general economy? And you typically get a higher number of answers, higher percentage of answers of people who say things are not good, whatever. And they say, well, how are you doing personally? Oh, I'm doing fine. And and so you get, when you get most people saying I'm doing fine, but they say that the general economy is not doing fine, well, there's obviously a disconnect there on what they really are, what's really happening.
Yeah, I did a deep dive on that several years ago. I actually called the group that does the consumer confidence surveys, and although they wouldn't give me their exact questions, they gave me background. And most of the questions they ask are basically, how do you think the economy is doing in general? And what we find is that they basically just reflect back whatever they hear on TV. That if the talk on TV is negative, then they talk negatively about the general economy. If the talk on TV is positive, then they talk positively. I think the only question, as you point out, that's really worthwhile is, how are you doing? I mean, we already know what the networks are saying. You know,
right, sure.
We already know if there's a general gloom attitude or a general euphoria attitude. What I want to know for these surveys is, there's one thing that each person knows better than me as an economist. Well, there may be other things, but there's one thing they definitely know better than me as an economist about the economy, is their own lives, how they're doing. I don't know their lives, so it's helpful to me to hear how they're doing.
Right. Yeah, and that's very good. Okay, so we're up against our next break, but I want to set it up a little bit. So in this,
I'll shorten my answers, Mike.
Okay, no, that's fine. That's fine. We'll have plenty of time after the break. But there was an article in the Wall Street Journal this morning that talked about the headline of the article was, stocks stayed strong first quarter, but rallies leaders change. And one of the graphs in there talked about the different asset classes and how they performed. They showed silver performing the best, up 14.2%, S&P technology sector up 12.2%. One of the ones I wanted to point out was the commodities, which is something you referred to in your article. It talks about cotton being up 9.5%, corn up 3.5%, and so forth. So, and you had some interesting thoughts on what you think is the best single commodity indicator of global growth, which was copper. So when we get back, we want to talk a little bit about copper and what your thoughts are and how that is a good indicator of global growth. And we'll talk a little bit about that, how that affects different things. And also, of course, we'll talk about interest rates and inflation and all those kind of things as well. So we want you to stay tuned. But if you've got a comment, you got a question, give us a call or a text, 877-235-9405. That's toll free from anywhere you can listen to me or are listening to me, 877-235-9405. We'll be back with more of Talking Money and Jerry Boyer, my special guest, in just a couple of minutes. If you have listened to Talking Money for any length of time, you realize that I'm trying to educate, not sell, any products. Unfortunately, so many financial shows are just that, shows. They're trying their best to discourage and even scare listeners in hopes that you'll make an appointment to visit with them, and that's when the real selling begins. Plan for sponsors this program with the primary purpose of giving you some real, actionable ideas that we think will help you maximize your financial opportunities, but with no hidden agenda, because we're not trying to sell anything. Of course, we always welcome the opportunity to visit with you if you think that the services we perform for our clients would benefit you. Our process is pretty straightforward. You simply call the Plan First offices. Our number is 800-588-7526. And tell Andrea or Tracy that you would like to speak with me, Mike Miller, or one of our other advisors. Now, you can see all of our advisory team on the Plan First website, which is at planfirst.com. Another easy way of starting the conversation is to simply send an email to info@planfirst.com. Our first goal is to find out enough information about your current situation and your objectives to determine if it makes sense for us to even meet. If so, we'll set up a convenient time for you to meet with me and several other advisors that I think would work best with you. That's based on our conversation that we had on the phone. At the initial meeting, we want to learn as much as we can about your expectations. The next step, assuming we both feel comfortable moving forward, is to send you a link to a risk profile questionnaire. Now, if you complete that questionnaire, we'll assume you're comfortable coming back for at least the next meeting. When we meet the second time, we'll answer any questions that you thought of since our first meeting, because oftentimes we think of questions we should have asked after we leave a meeting, and then we'll review the risk assessment together. Now, at this point, we'll let you know if we think we are a good fit and we think we can meet your expectations. And this is where people think the hard sell begins. But don't worry, if you're not ready to make that decision, we will literally leave you alone until you get back to us. That doesn't mean that we don't want you as a client. We want the decision to be well thought and deliberate. We think this is one of the reasons that the vast majority of clients that come to Plan First stay at Plan First. And the phone number for Plan First, once again, is 1-800-588-7526. Or email us at info@planfirst.com. He's a regular Forbes contributor and used to be on TV but got smart and decided it was not worthwhile taking all the time it takes to be on TV all the time, especially the requirements that a CNBC or even a Fox Business News would require of you. So we were talking.
I still go on from time to time, but kind of on my terms.
Sure, right. When you want to.
When I want to and when it's about a topic I've already researched, not a topic that they thought up.
Right. And then they say, hey, you need to research this so you can give us a couple of sound bites and make us sound
good. Yeah, right.
Make
and then that's your afternoon.
Yeah, right, sure. When you went on those, so did you do it remotely at a local station and get it piped into them, or did you have to go to New York or?
Usually locally. Sometimes I do New York and Washington, but that was kind of special occasions. I guest hosted once one of those shows. But it's locally, but locally is downtown. Downtown's an hour from here.
Okay.
Right? And you have to get there, as you know, 20 minutes early.
Sure.
It's a day.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like a scramble. It's kind of a desperate scramble for fame. I think at every a commentator at some point faces a choice in his life. Does he want wisdom or does he want fame? Does he want to feed his ego or does he want to feed his family by serving his clients? And, to me, that choice was an obvious one.
Well, and I think, of course, obviously on part of that is it's a marketing thing. So they want their talking head, their economists, their brain power, as they would have it put out there, is to be they're the ones. Obviously, they're on TV. They wouldn't be there if they weren't smart. So use our firm because we're there. So understand that a bunch too.
Yeah.
So before the break, we were talking about some of the thoughts you've had about what's going into 17, and you had mentioned the article about copper prices and how they may be an indicator. So walk through that with us.
Yeah, remember I said before that the thing that people who aren't economists know more than economists about the economy is what's going on in their own lives. Well, that reflects itself in markets. You know, a plumber decides to buy copper. A builder, I know plumbers mainly do plastic now, but not entirely.
Right.
You decide to build your own house, and there's copper in that house, or there's aluminum in that house. You know, that sends information into the market. And the more people are doing that, that sends up the price of, say, copper or aluminum. The more that you're willing to drive, that kind of gives a sense of what your demands are. Then that sends prices of oil up. Borrowing or saving, that affects interest rates. So what I'm saying is that market prices reflect the wisdom of the crowd. Now, the crowd isn't always wise. The crowd can become a mob, and that's where you get bubbles and busts and bubbles and panics. But there's a lot of knowledge distributed out there that experts don't have, and it gets reflected in market prices. So we've found that the single best forecaster of global economic growth is not any particular business. In fact, what they find is that the really big firms, like the household names that you know, are actually pretty bad at forecasting the global economy. And so are groups like the World Bank and the IMF. They're not very good. They're no better than randomness.
Not a good track record there. Yeah.
Not a good track record. So, now we can compare individual economist track record. But, rather than that, I'd say the better track record is the market itself. That when you have increases in copper prices in particular, copper seems to be the one that's best. Aluminum's also pretty good. Oil is also good, but oil can get – there's noise there from geopolitical risk, right?
Right.
Anytime something bad happens in the Middle East, oil goes up. That doesn't mean the global economy is getting better. But we don't really have copper so much as a geopolitical risk, not that there's none, right? I mean, you can have, some coup in South America, but generally, these industrial materials, silver is another one, although silver is as much an inflation forecaster as it is a growth forecaster, they can give us a pretty good idea what's going on. Now, they're not perfect at predicting the future economy. Nobody is. right? The future is unknowable to human beings, right? We're not omnipotent. All I'm saying is that markets in general are better than experts. So, now, you have to do some things with markets because sometimes the price goes down because there's more productivity. Sometimes the price goes up or down because of inflation. So you have to use certain statistical tools to kind of screen those effects out, right? Once you've accounted for production increases or decreases, once you've accounted for inflation, you know, what's left is basically demand for these metals. And it's a pretty good driver. It's a pretty good predictor of global economic growth. People try to use it to predict the U.S. economy. It doesn't work as well because these are global markets.
Yeah, sure. I don't know if you're familiar with Ivan Marchev at all. He's an economist that does a lot of work for the Navalier Investment Management Group. And he writes a weekly newsletter blog. And he was talking this week in his. He says he keeps an eye on the major commodity indexes because they're doing exactly the opposite of what they're supposed to do this time of year, going down and not up. Says, I realize that there was a lot of euphoria following the Trump election victory, but reality seems to be creeping back into the commodity markets. The number one consumer of oil and most commodities, for that matter, is China. I think this weakness in major commodity indexes is a combination of weak Chinese demand and abundant oversupply. Says, well, a couple of weeks of weak commodity prices is no big deal. It will become a very big deal if this extends deep into spring and summer. The fact that the commodity indexes are weak with a somewhat weak U.S. dollar indicates to me that this reflects a weak demand problem.
Yeah, and you also have to account for the fact that they're in the dollar, so you have to do something to take out the inflation effect. And I don't want to get into math, but you have to sort of take out some of those things, right? And you have to look. I mean, one of the things that's driven oil is we've had a huge production boom in oil, right? Fracking produces natural gas. You know, the same processes that we use to find natural gas are the ones we use to find oil. I mean, they're the same wells for the most part, the same processes. So the fracking revolution has given us a supply glut of oil. So some of the decline in the price of oil was supply increases. So, you know, you have to take that into account, but you were still left with a decline that was, we couldn't just explain it based on supply increases. The decline was too big. So there's something else going on. So you have to reason about this. What else is going on? Well, if it's not an increase in supply, then it's a decrease in demand. And then, well, who uses oil? Everybody, right? Everybody uses oil. Sure. Who uses more of it? Well, emerging market economies are more dependent on energy is a higher proportion of their economic output than ours. So that's an indicator that maybe some of the big emerging market players like China, that market participants are signaling that they don't have the same high growth rates. Now, they still might have higher growth rates than us. That's the thing. I mean, you know, we got into a normal 2% growth rate. You know, that was bad for us. China's bad was 6.5 to 7, if you can believe their numbers. It wasn't two, right? They weren't growing that slowly.
Right.
So, you know, you could still do well in emerging markets. Even if you have slowing global growth, just so long as emerging markets are on sale and just so long as they still have solid growth rates, even not as solid as previously was expected.
And we get back to the break. We'll talk more about where some good places to invest, how you foresee or perceive the current U.S. market and price-wise. I mean, a lot of listeners have that thought of, is it overpriced? You hear all the talking heads there again that know on CNBC are telling us whether they think it's overvalued or undervalued, and they all seem to have good reasons for that. But there's one of the other comments you made in this article, that, and we'll leave this one alone for the rest of the show today, is the subpar recovery. I mean, we've had positive growth for the last 8 years, but it's been certainly subpar growth. And what's your thought then, where how the commodities might influence this, but where interest rates, commodities, what's your best case on where we might be moving from subpar? Are we going to get back to high growth, normal growth? We're going to keep subpar. What's your best thought there?
After the break or now?
Now. Go ahead and give me your 60-second take on that, and then we'll get to our last break.
Best thought is we'll have an above-par recovery unless the tax cuts get delayed because of political wrangling, and then we've got a good chance of a business recession, maybe even an actual recession.
And how far out would you say that might be? Are we talking later this year? Are we talking next year?
Let's say that Trump can't get his tax cuts through this year. Then we are likely to have a contraction this year because business people are smart. They respond to incentives. And if Trump is basically saying, when my package passes, you'll be able to deduct 100% of your capital expenditures in the year that you make them. You know, if you buy a truck, you'll be able to deduct 100% of it. If you build a factory, you'll be able to deduct 100% of it. And then business people say, well, okay, but that's not now. That's next year. Then what do? They don't buy anything. They don't need to.
Yeah,
they
wait.
They sit on their hands,
sure.
Right? And so that point, that defers business activity, capital expenditures plummet, and we get a contraction.
All right. That was a good 60-second response. We'll go to our last break, give you one last chance to make a comment or to give us a call, 877-235-9405. We'll be back with last segment with my special guest, Jerry Boyer, in just a couple of minutes. Being appointed as a trustee, that's a huge responsibility. And maybe you're going to be named as a trustee in the future, but you need to know the responsibility that comes with that. Some of the more common types of trusts are family trusts. Sometimes we call those bypass trusts. Q-tip trust is another that's typically used. That provides a surviving spouse with a regular income while they are living, but it makes sure that your heirs get the money, not the children of the new spouse if they get remarried. And we also manage a number of charitable remainder trusts. Now, this is a great way to get a current tax deduction. Provides you and your spouse with a potentially higher monthly income from the exact same assets because of some tax savings there. But while you're both alive. And then when you're both gone, the money goes to your favorite church, ministry, or charity. Now, as the trustee, you have a huge fiduciary duty to be sure those trust assets are invested appropriately. Plus, you are the one that has to be sure that all the tax reporting that's very unique to trust is filed on time. Most people think that you need to use one of those big bank trust departments to handle the trust, but I think there's a good alternative that you should at least consider. Plan First currently helps clients with many different types of trusts. Now, Plan First typically acts as the trust advisor. That essentially means that we help you not only manage the assets according to the trust document, we're also going to help you actually operate the trust, which is even better when you realize that we don't charge any extra fee for that work. Now, if you need a corporate trustee, Plan First has a relationship with several local and national trust companies. I think this gives our clients access to some of the best, real, high-quality trust accounting and trustee services. And from what I've seen in the marketplace, that's a very competitive cost, too. Now, if you want to discuss this further with me, give me a call, 233-7405 or 1-800-588-7526. Or you can always send me an email at info@planfirst.com. Now back to more Talking Money. We got about 10 minutes left in Talking Money. My special guest, Jerry Boyer, he's the chief economist at Ronald Blue & Company out of Atlanta, as well as with Vidant Financial and a host of other things. And we're pleased to have Jerry with us on the program today. Right before the break, we talked about what Jerry's thoughts might be on where the Dow, this S&P 500, U.S. stocks in general, where they are, S&P 500 typically, what we look at as a broader market, even though the market's a lot bigger than that from number of companies, but not necessarily from capitalization. Two things recently, James Research people put out this week, the survey from Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, we find a significant number of fund managers responding. Equities are overvalued in a recent survey, highest since 2001, they said. They said, is this the death knell for the market advance? It's unlikely, as they've said before, market tops are typically long affairs. Last week, Jerry, I mentioned that there was an article in MarketWatch. Of course, it must be right because it was on MarketWatch. Crash guru warns the Dow could plunge to 14,800, and today's a date to watch. Well, that was back several weeks ago, and it didn't go to 14,800, but they were saying if the technical stars collide, whatever that means, as one chartist predicts, the blue chip gauge could soon plunge by more than 6,000 points to 14,800. That's nearly 30% lower based on Friday's close. So,
if there's a blood moon, maybe.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. And I quoted you.
Stars collide or there's a blood moon or something.
I definitely quoted you a couple of years ago because I'd asked you that specific question and we had a special program that we talked about just that effect and still waiting for that to happen. I guess we got to wait another 7 years. But, anyway, so what's your thought? S&P 500, overvalued? Is it going to, does that mean just stay away from it? Where do you stand along with this market guru?
I guess when he says that equities are overvalued, I guess that's the other one. I'd say, well, which equities? There's 4,000 equities in the United States, excuse me, and there's roughly 40 countries with highly liquid markets that you can buy just with a click of a of a mouse. So,
sure. Yeah, it didn't say the Bank of America survey just said he just all he quoted was equities are overvalued. That's all he said. So I assumed he meant U.S. equities, but you know.
Well, yeah, and that's a problem for me because the discussion is so U.S. centric. It's really strange. It's
sure.
You know, will the market? How's the market going to do? Right? And I know what people always mean by that. They mean how is the S&P or maybe the Dow going to do?
Right.
You know, there's a bond market. It's 3 times, depending on which one you're looking at, to the size of the stock market. And most of the equities aren't in the United States. So I don't really focus that much on the S&P and the Dow. What we tend to focus on is all of the markets in the world, commodity markets, bond markets, equity markets, across the world. And instead of asking, will quote unquote the market go up or down? Because that's a huge market and they often different parts go in different directions. We ask, to me, a simpler question. Well, I think the more relevant question, which is, which of these are more attractively valued relative to the others? Because you have to choose between real-world alternatives. Now, if everything is grotesquely overvalued, then cash is the most, you know, attractively valued.
Sure.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah, right. But so we're not really into what's the S&P going to do or is it valued properly, but it's more like relative valuation, right? And so as I look around the world, I think that a lot of emerging markets in general, and we've been overweight in emerging markets, and that's worked out well. But I don't want to brag about that because if you brag about overperformance, then you have to do what? About underperformance.
That's right, sure.
So, you know, we're not caught up in the overperformance, underperformance thing. All I'm saying is for the long run investor, emerging markets generally look better. Let me put it this way. For the long run investor, equities generally look better than fixed income, than bonds. And emerging markets generally look better than developed, but there's no reason to stop disaggregating at emerging markets. Emerging markets in countries that are moving towards freedom are more attractive than emerging markets in countries that are moving away from freedom. So, you know, the Brazils and the Venezuelas, which are basically socialist hellholes, I guess they're emerging, you can call them emerging markets, but they look to me like sub-emerging markets. Yeah. But the Taiwans, the Hong Kongs, the South Koreas, and this changes constantly because they have to be on sale. So what we're always looking is for countries that have good resiliency, good rule of law, good demographics, low debt, and are increasing their business freedom, and are on sale. And that changes, you know, from time to time. That's a constantly changing thing. So what we're constantly trying to do is move assets from overvalued and slow growth with anti-growth policies to undervalued with pro-growth policies. And over the long run, that greatly increases the probability you're going to hit your hurdle rate, say, of 4% real return or something like that.
Yeah, real return would be your grocery term minus whatever inflation takes, that difference.
Yeah, because you don't eat nominal returns. You eat real returns.
Real returns.
You take your returns and you take them to the grocery store, right? So you have to account for inflation and all the rest of it. And so what we do is we try to maximize the probability of getting more than 4% real return in the long run because it's a tough environment because everything is valued so high because the central banks have distorted valuations. The central banks bought lots of bonds. They made bonds super overvalued. That pushed people into stocks and that made them tend to be overvalued. So I know I'm not really answering your question, but I'm kind of changing the question a little bit.
No, that's fine.
Comparative valuation, right? What's comparatively attractive?
Sure.
And I would say it is largely it's the countries that are growing fast are the countries that are relatively poor. They've got room to grow. It's really hard for a developed country to grow at 6 or 7%. It's not that hard for a developing country to grow at 6 or 7%. So there's been some great stories out there, there's been some good performance. A lot of Southeast Asia is looking good. In the Index of Economic Freedom, the United States historically was always in the top 5. Now it's barely cracking the top 20.
That's amazing, isn't it?
So the reason that we always – it was during most of our lifetime, it was, S&P, because, you know, you had John Kennedy, who, you know, was president when I was born. You had – later on, you had Nixon and Carter, and they were both bad, and Ford wasn't very good. Then you had Reagan, who was had very good strong growth policies. You had Clinton, who at least in the second term had strong growth policies.
Forced to.
But now – But you know what's happened is the rest of the world has said, hey, look, America, if you don't want to be America, we're happy to be America. We like a higher standard of living. So a lot of we're now somewhere near Bahrain and Denmark in terms of the index of economic freedom. We're not even the freest country in North America. Canada is freer. Now, with Trudeau up there and Trump there, we probably are going to, you know, they're probably going to get less free and we're probably going to get more free.
Change, yeah.
But there has been a long-term decay in our economic freedom that goes back, you know, not just to Obama, it goes back to George W. Bush.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we've had some conversations, I know, as you have, and one of the things to help, it's been hard to overcome, though, for the last 6 years, is diversification, and it appears to not be working, because if you did, you invested in anything with the S&P 500, you look like you were an idiot, and what was wrong with you? How come you didn't know that was going to do so much better than everything else? But the longer that lasts, the less likely it's going to repeat itself is what
right.
we would tell, I tell
right,
listeners.
Right, because the S&P gets more overvalued, yeah. right.
So we got about a minute and a half. So diversification, it sounds like you're saying basically is, in spite of what the S&P 500 has done, it's at least is overvalued relative to other types of opportunities.
If you line up 100 investors in a line and you choose the middle performer, he lost money. Why is that? Because people buy what already went up and sell what already went down. They,
sure.
they manage through the rearview mirror. So they buy the S&P because it went up a lot. It is the standard mistake. It is the rookie mistake. But emotions are so strong that even smart people, I mean, Sir Isaac Newton bought in to the South Sea bubble. He's maybe one of the smartest guys who ever lived, but emotions overcame them. That's why you hire financial advisors, somebody to keep you from doing the dumb thing, which is to buy what's been going up a lot. Diversification makes sense over the long run. The problem is, you, if you're a financial advisor and you diversify, you're putting your client's interest ahead of your own, right?
Right,
because
absolutely.
If you underperform the S&P, it was still the right thing to do because diversification lessens risk. It's even in the Bible, Ecclesiastes. But you could risk losing the client who will go and then buy the thing that just went up. It'll hurt them.
All right, Jerry.
I got to cut you off.
We got about 10 seconds.
Yes.
Yes, very good. Good
yes.
last piece of advice. Well, thanks, Jerry, for joining us. We'll be back next week after about 5 seconds for the more Talking Money.